Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In 1889, President William Henry Harrison signed the proclamation which made South Dakota the 40th state to enter statehood. At that time, the state constitution was drafted, and today we'll dive into its pages a bit and understand it better. Helping us to do that, we have Patrick Gary. He's a law professor at the University of South Dakota. Professor Gary, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Also joining us, Mike Card. He's an associate professor of political science, also at USD. Professor Card, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here. I hope each of you are well.
Yeah, so far so good. Getting ready for a big big election day tomorrow, and one of the opportunities that South Dakotans have, of course, on the 2020 ballot is to amend the state constitution. So as we look at the anniversary that we have this week, as well as with the opportunity for voting, it's a good time to kind of think about what that constitution is and what it isn't. So Professor Gary, let's start with you. Some broad sweeping things about how we should think about the state constitution, because most of us spend any sort of mental bandwidth we have thinking about the U.S. Constitution.
Well, sure, and the two are very different, probably mostly in the sense that state constitutions are often documents of limitation. In other words, the state government has plenary power. In other words, the people forming the state have all the government power to begin with. So the Constitution doesn't confer power, unlike the federal Constitution, where the only power that the federal government has is power that's given to the federal government. And so, therefore, we oftentimes think of the federal Constitution then as creating this government, and the only powers that the federal government have are those conferred by the Constitution. That's not the case with state constitutions, as with South Dakota. And so we have with state constitutions that are usually much longer than the federal constitution, and with like actual policy prescriptions, like the South Dakota Constitution deals with education. The federal constitution doesn't really deal with individual policy prescriptions like that.
Yeah. Mike Card, tell me a little bit about how long South Dakotans have been able to make changes to that constitution. What's the history of that, of it being amended?
Well, it depends upon who's making the change. From the time of statehood on November 2nd of 1889, the legislature has been able to propose amendments to the Constitution, which would then involve a vote of the people to ratify those amendments. The ability of the citizenry to initiate a constitutional amendment resolved from the Constitutional Revision Commission's work, which presented a series of amendments to the Constitution to the state legislature in 1972, which were then voted upon by the people and adopted, allowing the citizenry to adopt amendments to the Constitution.
So why was that revision commission pulled together? Were there some broader problems that needed to be happened? I'm not sure which one of you wants to tackle that question, but going back to the 70s, what was the context of that?
The context of the Constitutional Revision Commission was largely one of modernizing the government. Some of it was to deal with the great limitations put on this on the governor, the legislature, and the judiciary from the original Constitution. You know, I think if we remember that our original Constitution was made during the Gilded Age, the idea was to limit the government as much as possible, although, as Professor Gary noted, the state's power is plenary, meaning full and complete. Only limits on the state constitution that are contained in the U.S. Constitution and obviously appropriately enacted laws of the national government and the state constitution itself. The Gilded Age, the framers of our Constitution were dealing with what they considered to be the limitations of of legislators, the limitations of executives. These weren't theoretical limitations. They'd experienced what they considered to be a large number of carpetbagger governors sent here by the president as political favors to senators and representatives, as well as individuals trying to feather their own beds, if you'll let me use that metaphor. So there were lots of limitations, including 45 specific limitations on what the legislature could do, and several others that were limiting what a governor could do. Appropriations were often made directly to boards and commissions to limit the power of the governor. The members of those boards and commissions were to be approved by the state Senate. It was largely in attempts to limit each of the branches of government to keep them from taking away the sovereignty of the people.
Professor
Mike,
Gary,
you bring up a good point.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to piggyback on what Mike brought up in terms of the Gilded Age and the corruption of the territorial governors. So that's really a remarkable aspect of the South Dakota Constitution, is that it came about as it was being, it went through three different constitutional conventions during the 1880s. And one of the big motivating circumstances were these territorial governors that Mike mentioned, that actually get appointed out of Washington and then come to South Dakota. Governor Ordway, and Mike, you could probably tell a lot of interesting stories about territorial Governor Ordway. And so he really infuriated South Dakotans at the time with some of the, he unilaterally moved the territorial capital from what's now South Dakota to what's now North Dakota. And I think because of that, the framers of the South Dakota Constitution were very wary about power given to the state, particularly executive power. So you see, as Mike mentioned, there's a lot of limitations in the South Dakota Constitution. I think it kind of came up during the COVID crisis, too, when there were calls for the governor to take various emergency powers, and when you look at the Constitution, the executive does not have the kind of power, the governor does not have the kind of power that the governor might have in other states.
So who are those framers? Are there framers of the state Constitution? How do we think about that? Professor Gary, you first on that one. And then Mike can jump in and expand.
The framers aren't known like we know the framers of the federal Constitution, but the Constitution that was ratified in 1889 actually goes back to 1883. There was a constitutional convention in 83 and in 85, and then finally the very last one in 89. And so South Dakota had three different constitutional conventions in trying to get itself as a state. And those constitutional conventions were not authorized by Congress like they usually would be. Congress would authorize the state to hold a constitutional convention, draft a constitution, then have it ratified by the voters. The first two constitutions weren't like that because South Dakota was sort of fighting to become a state. And I might pass that over to Mike to be able to describe sort of the various political obstacles then that were facing South Dakota's attempt. So it spent pretty much all of the decade of the 80s trying to become a state and trying to draft up a constitution.
Yeah. Mike Card, you want to add to that?
Well, there were a large number of territories that were trying to become states in 1889, Idaho, Montana, what has become North Dakota, South Dakota, Washington, Wyoming, and Utah were all framing constitutions in order to meet the requirements of a bill enacted by Congress. We call it the Omnibus Bill, which was actually shepherded through Congress by then-Senator William Henry Harrison as the chairman of the Committee on Territories. So there was lots of impetus to, as we noted, limit Congress. But this was largely because there were political struggles coming out of Reconstruction, where the then Democratic Party, which is very different than today's Democratic Party, was not wanting to introduce a set of new Republican senators and electoral votes, and so they were fighting statehood. In addition, they were able, many senators were able to have senatorial privilege in terms of nominating territorial officials, which, as we noted before, was the governor, the judges of the Supreme Court, and a few other lesser-known officials. So they liked the territorial status. In addition, by having political appointees from elsewhere, most of whom returned to that elsewhere after their terms were up, were often engaged in investment opportunities in the state. And as we mentioned, Governor Ordway was certainly one of those who facilitated investment in the state, largely by railroads, grain companies, timber companies, to pillage the state, so to speak, to charge outrageous rates for shipping the grain, not offering decent prices once they were able to ship it. And if anything, reform was the mood of the day in framing Constitution throughout the decade of the 1880s.
So I want to talk a little bit about contemporary times, but before that, Mike Card, this is are things like, you know, women's suffrage, slavery, what's happening with indigenous populations, is all this part of the political soup that this is happening within?
Well, you know, we do have to recognize that Caucasians were not the first inhabitants of this land, that most of the land was ceded to the federal government in exchange for reserves lands called reservations today. That was largely a federal phenomenon because the U.S. Constitution reserves dealing with the Indian tribes to Congress, for better and worse. So, but other aspects certainly dealt with what's those particular issues of women's suffrage, minority representation, and their minority representation is trying to reflect that individual votes. If there was a 51-49 split in a legislative district, that the 49% might be disenfranchised. So the framers contemplated three-person House districts, and they would be elected by individuals having three votes to cast in that district, and whoever then won those three seats, the top vote getters, would be seated as a representative. Women's suffrage was, I think, most interesting because the framers granted the right to vote to immigrants who were not U.S. citizens if they wished to become citizens. And at the same time, women's suffrage votes did not pass. Prohibition passed, which was sort of a, it was a religious battle at the time between the mainstream Protestant churches and Catholic churches or members of those denominations.
And not sure irrelevant to, I could just sit in your class all day.
Yeah.
But I want to ask Professor Gary about some of the quirks or surprises in this Constitution as you study it. And because what happens, and I'll just, you know, for your context on this program, whenever we have conversations about constitutional amendments in the context of, you know, voters getting to weigh in on something, there will be guests who say, don't mess with the state constitution. It's kind of, you know, almost like it's a sacred document. And there's others who will point out some of the things that are in it and go, come on, that's a bad argument. And they go back and forth. And of course, that's the political gamesmanship of an election. But from your perspective, what are some of those quirks and surprises that live in the state constitution, Professor Gary?
I would say probably the biggest, I wouldn't call it a quirk, maybe the biggest unique aspect to the Constitution is the initiative and referendum, which is what we're talking about right now. You know, and that's why when voters vote on a on election day about constitutional amendments. You know, oftentimes it's through the initiative and referendum process, and South Dakota was the first state to have that in their constitution. And so it was known as a direct democracy provision. So through this initiative and referendum, citizens can go ahead and propose a law or repeal a law on their own, acting sort of outside of the state legislature. And that was a populist kind of provision at the time. Mike said that this was, you know, the Constitution came about during the Gilded Age, and during the Gilded Age, there was this populist movement. And populism then is probably different than what we think of populism now. But there was a great populist movement in South Dakota. South Dakota was one of the states where populism was, you know, most prevalent and most successful, certainly within the elected branches. And the initiative of a referendum was one of those provisions. South Dakota is the very first state to have it, and we still see it to this day that it's being exercised really all the time.
That's interesting.
You know, one thing I'd like to add to that is consideration was for what was then called the Dakota Plan, and it almost passed in North Dakota. It didn't achieve quite the success in South Dakota, and that was to have a very small 25-person unicameral body, meaning one chamber sort of legislature, to handle day-to-day issues, and every significant issue would be brought to a vote of the people. That's how much they distrusted elected officials.
Well, and Mike Card, that brings me to my next thought, which is another thing that people discuss in the political rhetoric with bringing forth something they want to see changed instead of bringing an initiated measure, this idea that they don't trust the state legislature not to overturn it, and therefore it needs to be in the state constitution. Some things haven't changed, and there is a distrust of lawmakers right now. Do you see it the same way, or can you add to that at all?
Well, I mean, that was an early on debate between Governor Millett and Judge Cooley, a noted constitutional authority of the time. And it's a very much an anti-originalist perspective that didn't win. Governor Millett argued that we need to put everything into the Constitution so that it makes it difficult to change. And once it's there, so that the legislature can't take it away from the people. Judge Cooley argued that times change, men change, new things are invented, new devices, new schemes, new plans, new uses of corporate powers, and we have to be able to adapt to the changes of the day. Instead, almost every constitution from the Gilded Age is full of statutory law that just happens to be in the Constitution.
That's interesting. And the program 1A that was on just before us, I'm not sure if either of you heard it, but they were talking about poverty and some things that are baked in from those days. So what an interesting thread to sort of carry on. Before I let you go, any final thoughts that either of you have? Professor Gary, we'll start with you, and then give Professor Card a chance to close us off. But any final thoughts that you have about the South Dakota State Constitution? It's fascinating. You've written a book, haven't you, Professor Gary?
Right. It's a book on the South Dakota Constitution. I guess I would probably mention we haven't talked about education. You know, education is very prominent within the Constitution itself. And in fact, the people, General Beadle, of course, is what was the leader of this group, really advocated for a constitution so as to protect the state lands. The state lands were dedicated to education, but they didn't want them sold off, you know, cheaply and kind of squander that. So they really wanted the Constitution, which set a numerical price for those lands so that they wouldn't be squandered. And, of course, that led to really the foundation for the public financing of education in the state of South Dakota.
Fascinating. Mike Card, anything you want to say before we let you go? This, I'm sure, will come up in future conversations as well.
Well, I want to leave us with a quote by a scholar of the day who was looking at the constitutions that were developed in what was then known as the Northwest States. And this is Thorpe, whose note was, "It is the clear understanding of how to run a government that the safety of a government depends. Our fathers tried to settle on what principles a government should be founded. The framers of the day were settling on what principles government should be administered. And I think what that represents is that our Constitution is full of more or less permanent laws. It's easier to amend the state constitution than the national constitution. But that also means that it can live with us, that we can make changes as we see fit. The framers of the day were concerned of what the legislative power would not meet the needs of the people, so they made sure to create provisions that dealt with the people being able to overrule the legislature. On any given issue, that might be a good thing or a not so good thing.
But so for voting tomorrow, is it just 50%? So whoever gets the more votes is how we amend the Constitution, or is there some kind of different numerical game that we're playing, Mike?
It's a different numerical game to get a petition onto the ballot, but once it's okay on the ballot, it's 50% plus one.
There we go. Mike Card is an associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Patrick Gary is a law professor at USD. Thanks as well. It's nice to meet you.
Well, thanks. Good to be on with both of you.